Good morning. This is Bishop Phoebe Rofe of the Episcopal Diocese of West Tennessee, and welcome to Faithfully Memphis on WYXR 91.7 FM. Each week, we have the opportunity to explore a little bit about a person of faith who's involved either locally or regionally or nationally to learn about their work and ministry and the role of faith in their life. So we start each week's program with a saint of the day. And because Monday we are celebrating the birthday of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., which is a federal holiday, Dr. King is the saint that we're going to learn a little bit more about today. Dr. King was a Baptist minister, and he was an activist and leader in the civil rights movement, known for advancing civil rights through nonviolence and civil disobedience. He participated in and led marches for the rights of African Americans to vote, to no longer be confined to segregated institutions, and other basic civil rights. One of the things that is so amazing about Dr. King's life for me is to remember that he was quite young when he was doing all of these things. For example, when he led the 1955 Montgomery bus boycott, he was 26 years old. And when he helped organize the 1963 March on Washington, where he delivered his famous I Have a Dream speech on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, he was 34 years old. He won the Nobel Peace Prize in October of 1964, and at the time, he was 35 years old and the youngest person to receive that award. Of course, there have been some younger persons since then. In the end of his life, he expanded his focus to include opposition to poverty. He had a critique of capitalism, and he was also opposed to the Vietnam War. In particular, his critique of the Vietnam War was it diverted money and resources that could have been spent on anti-poverty programs domestically. And one of the things that he said at the time was, and I quote, "A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death." Excuse me. So in 1968, Dr. King was planning a Poor People's Campaign, which was going to be held in Washington, D.C. And the purpose of that was to encourage the government to invest in rebuilding American cities. Unfortunately, he was assassinated on April the 4th, 1968, here in Memphis, Tennessee, at the Lorraine Motel, at the age of 39. So what a great deal that he was able to accomplish in such a short life. Dr. King would actually be 92 years old this year if he were still alive. Now, on Monday, we will celebrate Martin Luther King Jr. Day as a national holiday. This holiday began in select cities and states in 1971, but it was a real struggle to get this day as a federal holiday. Representative John Conyers introduced legislation to establish Dr. King's holiday as a federal holiday in every legislative session from 1968 until 1983. The bill came to the floor for a vote in the House of Representatives in 1979, but it failed. It finally passed the House and Senate in 1983, and President Reagan signed it into law, but the first federal holiday wasn't celebrated until 1986. each state had to adopt the law locally, and it took until the year 2000 for all 50 states to acknowledge Dr. King's holiday. So as we remember and reflect on the life and legacy of Dr. King, I don't want us to view it with rose-colored glasses. Let's not forget that during the course of his life, he was vilified by many white Americans. Dr. King received repeated death threats and attempts against his life. His home was bombed. He was also repeatedly arrested and jailed. And on one of these instances in 1963, he was jailed in Birmingham, Alabama. And from his jail cell, he composed an open letter from a Birmingham jail as a response to a letter he had received from 8 white Alabama clergymen. They were opposed to his nonviolent efforts. They argued that the battle for civil rights should be fought exclusively in the courts and not in the streets. So they didn't support sit-ins, marches, and other forms of nonviolent, peaceful protests. The Bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of Alabama and the Bishop Coadjutor of the Episcopal Diocese of Alabama were two of the men who signed this letter. In response, Dr. King wrote, and I quote, "Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly." Dr. King also wrote in this letter that white moderates posed a challenge comparable to that of white supremacists, saying, and I quote, "Shallow understanding from people of goodwill is more frustrating than absolute misunderstanding from people of ill will. Lukewarm acceptance is much more bewildering than outright rejection." Dr. King also argued that the white church needed to take a principled stand on these issues or risk, and I quote, "being dismissed as an irrelevant social club." So we hope that on Monday, you will find some way to be of service to others as we celebrate the life and legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Now, I understand that his favorite gospel singer was Mahalia Jackson, and his favorite song of hers was "Precious Lord, Take My Hand." So now we're going to play Mahalia Jackson singing "Precious Lord, Take My Hand."
Take my hand,
What a beautiful rendition of Precious Lord, Lead Me Home by the one and only Mahalia Jackson. So this morning, it is my honor and pleasure to have as our special guest, Faith Morris, who is the Chief Marketing and External Affairs Officer of the National Civil Rights Museum. Faith grew up in Memphis and graduated from the University of Memphis before beginning her career as a marketing and communications strategist that took her to lots of different places, and now she's back home. So, Faith, good morning, and thank you so much for joining Faithfully Memphis.
Oh, good morning. I'm so glad to be here. It was wonderful to hear Mahalia sing that, because we certainly do that a lot at the museum.
Yes, great. So I wondered, to start off with, could you tell us a little bit about your childhood and what it was like growing up in Memphis and the role that faith played in your life?
Well, grew up in South Memphis, South Parkway, an area that was full of educators. My parents, both Leon and Norma Griffin, were educators, and my mother continued to be an educator for most of her life. And it was a very interesting childhood. I was involved in so much. At the time, I thought I was doing way too much, but my parents had me busy. I was dancing. I was, you know, piano at school. And I went to Hamilton for 12 years from elementary and graduated there. It was one of the first classes. Every time we had a new school, our class was the first one to be in it. So I really had a great childhood, great friends, very involved in so many organizations, and got a chance to see just based on some of the friendships I had, you know, I really didn't know that we weren't rich, honestly. I had no idea. I found that out a little later after I was grown and realized what, because my parents, through education system, did get a lot of benefits. And I don't think we talk a lot about how well teachers were taken care of then. Mm. But while I was here, and I didn't leave until 1990 going to Chicago, I started in media right out of college. Started in radio, was a reporter, and that was fun, and then ended up being the main anchor. This was at WNC and FM 100. Mm-hmm. Left there and became news director at WHBQ. So I loved media, but one thing that I realized was that I wasn't as excited, although our news has always amazed me. I always want to know what's going on. But what excited me more was producing, you know, determining what would be reported and how we would shape the show. So I became news director, then I became public affairs director and, you know, created the first promotions campaign for the station. And that really gave me more of an insight on my interest in PR and, you know, really what was going on in the world. Mm-hmm. Started my own consultancy, and one of my first clients was Holiday Inn, and they hired me. I didn't get to stay a consultant very long. They hired me, and it was wonderful at Holiday Inn. Got to travel all over. But from Holiday Inn, and Holiday Inn was bought, and, you know, things changed there. Helped to communicate, you know, the purchase. But moved to Chicago, and that opened up a whole new world. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's great when you can go away. You know, I love this city. Go away and see what the rest of the world looks like, mm-hmm. and then come back and bring what you've learned here. And I think that I have worked really hard to do that.
Mm-hmm. So when you came back to occupy, I guess, your current role mm-hmm. at the National Civil Rights Museum, did you sense any changes? I mean, how much has Memphis changed over the years?
Well, honestly, Memphis has changed a lot and not a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't feel like I was in a foreign town. One, because I'd always be back because my parents were still here until I brought them to Chicago when they were getting ill and needed more care, and I needed to be closer. So when I came back, I have really great long-term friends here. The social scene, you know, was a little different. I've always been involved in a lot of organizations. You know, my sorority, Delta Sigma Theta, has always kept me grounded on, you know, what was happening, and so that helped a lot. And stayed in contact with all of them while I was still in Chicago. So I didn't have to be introduced a lot to new things. You know, politics always changes the environment, so that certainly had changed since I was away.
Mm-hmm.
But what it was that I was really hoping to do when I came back and felt that there was a great opportunity to do it was just to be able to give some input on how to elevate some mm-hmm. of the things that, you know, we kind of took for granted, you know, being here in Memphis.
Yeah. So that's a great segue into our discussion about your role at the mm-hmm. National Civil Rights Museum. And faithfully, Memphis is live streamed, so it can be picked up all over the country. Mm-hmm. And there may be some of our listeners who aren't even familiar with the National Civil Rights Museum.
Okay.
So I wonder if you might tell us a little bit about the museum, its history and origins, and what the purpose of it is.
Well, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated in 1968. He was staying at the Lorraine Motel.
Mm-hmm.
The motel at that time, owned by Walter and Lori Bailey, was one of the few places in Memphis that black folks could come to mm-hmm. and it'd be a safe haven. It was included in the Green Book, and it was a hopping place. It was a beautiful motel, and it Stax would have their recording artists, their doctors and whoever was coming to Memphis would stay there. So it's got a beautiful portfolio of people, pool outside, a lot of social activities there. When Dr. King was assassinated, it went from being, you know, a bustling business to suffering because people didn't want to stay there. They wanted to, you know, come and pay tribute. You know, it became a memorial to Dr. King. A wreath was placed, which stayed. There was a wreath that was in front of room 306, which is the room that he died outside of, since 1968. And there was a ceremonial changing of the wreath every year once the museum was established. There was a group of citizens, De'Armi Bailey and A.R. Willis and Chuck Scruggs and so many more that raised money to save the Lorraine. It was in foreclosure. So in 1991, so that was a while.
Yeah, you know, from 68 to 91, okay.
The museum opened, and it opened as a tribute to not only Dr. King, because and it was a historic site. It's one of the few historic sites, the places where history happened that are now, you know, actually museums. But it also was to chronicle the civil rights movement. That story had not been told in a way that was complete. It certainly wasn't told in the way that it needed to be as a part of history, as, you know, in curriculum in schools. So it was important to be able to introduce the world to the thousands of men and women who, you know, risked their lives to register to vote, to get the vote, to, you know, integrate schools, to, you know, work on the whole economic ecosystem that was in the country, just really pushing civil rights and what the Constitution gave us by law. Dr. King certainly was a strategist. He was one of the best networkers there, you know, was. People were coming from all over the country to the South to try to make things right. His work is displayed in the museum. We certainly talk about his lessons and his legacy and his life always. But we also extend it by mirroring what's going on in the museum with what people are seeing outside. You know, we push the historic aspects of the interpretation in the museum from slavery. And it was important to start with slavery because we feel that it was those 400 years that shaped this nation. And there's so much of what happened then that is a carryover to what's happening now. So we tell that story in great detail. But we go from that to his assassination and past that to what's happening outside your window. We have rapid response exhibits. When there's something in the news, you know, we may pull together an exhibit so folks can come and see and participate and talk about what's happening. We're called the new public square because people come to the museum. We have difficult conversations. If you don't want to know the truth, you don't want to really hang out with us. And you certainly don't want to go through the museum because, you know, you leave there, even people that feel that they are pretty well versed on history. And we do push that it is American history, that there's always something there that you didn't know. There's something there that needed to be explained a little further. There are people there that you had no idea the work that they did and the role that they played. That's really what we do on a daily basis. When the protests were going on, when the Women's March was happening, you know, there were millions in D.C., there was 6,000 on our campus. Doing the same thing. And when the protests were happening, they started or stopped, you know, at our campus, ended at our campus.
Yeah, so when I toured the museum last year, 2019, maybe almost a year and a half ago, I had assumed that it was going to be primarily focused on the sanitation worker strike and the events leading up to Dr. King's assassination. And I have to say that I was blown away by the comprehensive scope of the exhibits, the quality, the fact, as you said, that it does document all 400 years of the African-American experience in this country. So it is so much more than just what happened in Memphis in 1968.
And it is important for us to tell the story of what happened in Memphis, but solely not that. But that story also had not been told in great detail.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we think the sanitation workers are rock stars. We hang out with them as much as we can. When we did MLK 50, which was the commemoration of the 50th mm-hmm. anniversary of Dr. King's assassination, and it was a global tribute to, you know, who he was and what he did and the principles and platforms and you know, what he was living through in his final years. And, you know, we try to stress that Dr. King was no longer dreaming.
Correct.
You know, he was an angry man, probably closer to Malcolm X, and Malcolm X had gotten closer mm-hmm. to, you know, they kind of was swapping roles a little bit, because he was pushing really hard on his fight against militarism, you know, a huge fight mm-hmm. against Vietnam, which may have been more than anything else that contributed to his death,
mm-hmm.
But certainly also still pushing justice and you know, education and housing and, you know, economics. So we have patterned what we do at the museum to that. But we needed to bring this world in on understanding what Dr. King, this man, was in his final years and how much what he was standing for and fighting for, we are still fighting
mm-hmm.
for.
We are. So I wonder, you know, looking at the events from our television screens or cell phones of the past week and a half at our nation's capital,
mm-hmm.
as we are yet again in a cycle of perhaps having to counter armed protesters with some sort of nonviolent response. What are your thoughts about the life and the legacy and the example of Dr. King for our young activists today?
Well, I think Dr. King would be the first to say we have two nations here.
Mm-hmm.
And what he would describe as what happened on January 6th is probably the best visual of bias and racism mm-hmm. and privilege that you can have. Everyone who is tied into the news or to social media had to have seen the difference in the images when Black Lives Matter went to the Capitol, and there were hundreds of National Guard standing ready to,
right.
you know, control what was a peaceful protest. And what was not a peaceful protest was not treated that way.
Mm-hmm.
And we say, as we think Dr. King would have said, is that had Black Lives Matter been there on January 6th and had approached the Capitol in the way that the rioters did, there would have been black bodies everywhere.
Right.
You know, we regret that there were five that we
right.
know of that died or suffered injury because of it. But it feels like a lot of that could have been avoided, and that's truly politics, honestly. So what we hope that our protesters, you know, and we call them activists, we call
mm-hmm.
them actors, we call them, and actors not in the dramatic sense, but actors in that they get things done.
Right.
What we're finding is that the ones that were on our campus, that came every day, that were intentional about making a difference, that didn't want to hear that it couldn't happen,
mm-hmm.
that really were more strategic than I've ever seen them. One of the criticisms that we've had with some of the protests is that they were more emotional
right.
than strategic. And I didn't see that this time. They had civil disobedience training on campus. Mm. There were hundreds of people, black and white and everything in between,
right.
you know, working. And I sat in on a few of those sessions, and one of the things that I thought they really got from what Dr. King did was the white participants learned that they were the protectors, that what would happen to them would be nowhere near what would have happened to the black participants.
Mm-hmm.
and they would surround them, you know, and create this barrier.
Almost like a buffer.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, officials respond to that, and that's genius. It was so amazing to see how diligent they were, how many hours they spent. You know, they were out there all day. I don't know where they were working, you know, because they weren't. It was mostly, honestly, though, starting at around, you know, 6 o'clock.
Right.
You know, in the evening. And they would stay until, you know, we'd have to kick them out at around 10 after a while. Just to make sure that we all stayed safe. And, you know, we talked to our police officers and told them, you know, we want you to come, but you come with the intent of protecting.
Right.
We're not doing anything to them. And the relationship that we have with our police department is not the relationship that, you know, we hear all the time. They have been phenomenal, and they understood.
Mm-hmm.
And so they came, and they protected the activists, and they protected the museum.
Right.
At that time, there were still people coming to the museum.
Oh.
And, you know, and they were coming in droves, and we needed them to kind of part the ways. They even protected the museum. And somebody was sitting on, there's the rail that leads you to the balcony.
Yes.
Someone was sitting on the balcony, and they said, not us, you got to get off of there. We respect this place.
Right.
You know, and we said, okay, well, then you guys get it.
Yeah.
You get it.
Yeah. So under normal circumstances, I imagine that there would be lots of things happening this weekend at the museum leading up to Monday. But of course, we find ourselves in, is this what, month 10 of this global pandemic, which is its own separate conversation. But how has COVID impacted the work of the museum, and what ways for individuals who would like to actually do something concrete to celebrate Dr. King's life instead of just sleeping in on Monday? What opportunities are there, even in the midst of the pandemic, to do things this weekend?
So do know this. The King holiday is one of the biggest gatherings in Memphis at the museum.
Mm-hmm.
Some 12,000 people come. Some people plan their annual vacation around
right.
coming to the museum. So we have, you know, a great Memphis audience or a great Mid-South audience that comes, but we have so many people that travel in.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a day of service, truly. 600 volunteers would typically be with us. We need them with all those
right.
folks. And they would come in, and some of them have been with us for, you know, 10, 15 years. They know the drill. So we would be so used to having the museum full.
Right.
So used to having families. We'd have tents, you know, with the community organizations talking about what they do. Breast cancer, you know, mammogram tests. We would always do a food drive, and they would get some of the biggest numbers that they would get all year, and blood drive,
mm-hmm.
biggest numbers again. So folks really knew what to do, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But this time, because of COVID and because the museum is again closed,
right?
There was no way we wouldn't do it, as you know, when the museum closed in March. Which was just a few days before we needed to recognize the assassination on April 4th, which
right.
is another big thing. Now we're doing the same thing
right.
a few days before his birthday to determine how do we commemorate this important day. So virtual is our world. We are, you know, everything is virtual now. And frankly, I think virtual is going to hang around. That's the gift that COVID gave us. But we have some beautiful programming. One of the things we will always do is remind folks or reveal to folks what Dr. King stood for. You know, this man that was born King was here for a purpose, and he didn't get to stay very long. He was 39.
Right.
And people are surprised, 39? How did he do all of that,
right.
you know, in 39 years? But he was busy, and he had a big agenda, and he spread his love and his words of advice and, you know, caution. He was a prophet. And so we talk about it. We try to make it a happy time. Dr. King actually loved to have fun.
Yeah.
He joked around, you know. You would think that he was disturbed the whole time. And he was as serious as he could be when he needed to be serious. But he also, as a relief, liked to have fun. So we always include a lot of music.
Mm-hmm.
This time we have created some performances in the museum in a way we never have. So, you know, go to civilrightsmuseum.org. Hang out on our website all the time so you can know what we're doing, civilrightsmuseum.org. There is a link there that'll mm-hmm. take you to the virtual celebration that we'll do. Dr. Hassan Jeffries, who was one of the lead scholars when we did the major renovation for the museum in 2014, who we have made a lead scholar. We just kept him because he's so phenomenal. And he does this hard history. You uh-huh. gotta follow him, the hard history. We had him, Noel Trent, who is the director of interpretation, collections, and education, and she's the one who does the King Day and, you know, all the King interpretation. Interviews him, there's a conversation that they have, and talking about Dr. King, who he is, how he was, mm-hmm. why he was here, and about the King holiday. If you know, with the civil rights movement, nothing was easy. And the King holiday was not easy,
right,
getting that established. And we wanted to remind people, you know, how it came about. And also a chance to talk about Coretta Scott King.
Yes.
Because she stepped right in, you know, where her husband left off. But she certainly was the one who established the holiday.
Mm-hmm.
So we always try to pay homage to her.
Yes. Well, when I registered for the online event that's going to be on Monday,
yeah. You
all also have a little promotion going. If you register, you can get, I think, a small Starbucks
coffee or cocoa
yes. at a local Memphis Starbucks location.
Isn't that
so I thought that was great.
Yeah. No, they've been wonderful partners. We have so many people, honestly, and we just should have just one big old thank you that
yes.
goes out every morning just for the heck of it, because there's somebody that's forever giving to the museum. They want to preserve the museum, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they give a dollar, they get 10,000, they give 500,000, they give 25 cents, but the point is that they want to participate in what they think is a positive place, a mm-hmm. positive influence, one that is anchored in Memphis but reaches globally.
Right.
We bring people from all over the world to Memphis. They get a chance to see what this city is about, but also what this movement is about.
Mm-hmm.
They get to hang out at the museum. We get to hear their story. It's something to walk through the museum with somebody who has lived the movement.
Right.
You know, and they'll say, you know, I knew who that was, or that's me, or that was my mama, or, you know, I was at the March on Washington, and they tell their stories. It's amazing. We walk through the museum. You know, how many times do I walk through the museum? And my office is not in the museum. The executive office is across the street. They don't need us in the way, right? But I'm always there, and I see something different or something I needed to go back to every time,
mm-hmm.
every time.
Yeah. So the museum has been in the news recently, not just because we're going to be celebrating Dr. King's birthday on Monday, but Terry Freeman mm-hmm. has announced that she is going to be leaving the museum, I believe, next month. And my experience of interacting with her is that she has been a phenomenal leader of the museum in this phase of its history and life. And mm-hmm. we certainly send Godspeed and blessing to her, but we're going to miss her. And I wonder, what are your thoughts about what the future has in store for the next chapter of the museum's history?
You know, we had a very tearful senior team meeting yesterday. And we'll have another one before she leaves. She is packing and heading out. But Terry did bring a lot of really phenomenal things to the museum. And her predecessor, Beverly, you know,
yes.
she picked up, you know, where Beverly left off. Beverly created this new museum, and it was important with this new museum that we create this outreach and education and, you know, awareness of what this movement is, what it should be, and how the museum needs to play a role in it. Mm-hmm. A tight-knit team, and Terry really did pull the team together. And the good thing about it is that much of what has happened in the success of the museum has been done through teamwork.
Yes.
So Terry's leaving, and God, it will be a huge hole. And she and I have gotten very close. The good part is that the work that we've done will continue.
Yes.
In fact, you know, there are several opportunities of even expanding what we're doing, and, mm-hmm. and we're looking at that. We'll always stay true to telling the civil rights story. We will always stay true to being a place of safety in having difficult discussions, you know, difficult topics. We will always try to think through what Dr. King would want us to emphasize. We have as our programming platform the six pillars that he was most concerned about. Mm-hmm. And frankly, we didn't need to expand much past that because they are still, you know, issues that this nation, this community, this mm-hmm. city is working through now. To stay true to what Dr. King lived and died for, but to also make sure that we create an opportunity and help with the voice of the younger generation who have made it very clear that they have very little patience.
Right.
And they want, you know, us older folks to stand down and let them take over. But in a respectful way of asking hard questions and understanding, so how did we get here? You know, why is this, you know, why are we having to work so hard to pull out of this hole? And being, you know, really ready for the charge. They're ready for the charge. That is the most beautiful picture you can imagine. Mm-hmm. That I do feel that we are in good hands. I do feel that they're looking and listening and learning from what has happened. How many times do you say, if you don't know your history, you know,
you'll repeat it.
Right.
That's right.
And it's so true. It's more than a hashtag. It really is something that we need to pay attention to. So there's great hope for this museum. There's great opportunity. There's a lot that we've done that has led the way museums operate. We're more than a museum, and we'll continue to do that. It's so important for us to marry what you learn through understanding the civil rights story and apply that to what you're living through during a civil rights, you know, nation. I hesitate always to describe the civil rights movement as historical.
Right.
Because there are two movements. There's one that we need to learn of that happened during Dr. King's days and all those that made what we are improving upon now. But there's this new movement that's happening that is pulling from that and doing even more.
Mm-hmm.
And so we will support that and give them as much room as they need to get that work done, bring in and help identify the folks that we think excel in it and share what they're doing so we can all do it better. And really help young people to understand that movement wasn't full of old people. They weren't old when they were doing that. They were in their teens and early 20s. Right. They were college students, some of them high school students, out there, you know, in the streets, you know, doing and saying and making sure that their voices were heard and training to make sure that strategically they were getting that job done.
Right. Well, what a great way to conclude the interview on this note of hope about the future, and especially as the young folks are leading the way.
Absolutely.
I want to thank you so much for your willingness to come and be on the show. And we're hoping that everybody will find a concrete way to celebrate the life and legacy, not only of Dr. King, but all of the unsung heroes
Absolutely,
of the civil
yes.
rights movement. And we're going to now play one of the songs that in some way probably helped to get Dr. King's birthday as a federal holiday by Stevie Wonder.
Thank you. of all people. It was in the dream that you had so long ago that lives in all of the hearts of people. Make the dream become a reality. I know we will, because our hearts tell us so.
So now we are in the segment of the show that is called Stump the Bishop. And I have a couple of questions that have come in from youth in the diocese that I'm going to address this week. So the first one is, what are my favorite road trip snacks? Well, I tend to like salty things when I'm traveling. So my favorite road trip snacks would include pretzels, popcorn, Cheez-Its, and nuts. I love nuts of all kinds. You know, if someone packs fresh fruit, I'm going to eat it. But if I'm grabbing it, it's probably going to be something salty. The second question is, Bishop, were you ever grounded when you were growing up? Well, you know, growing up in the 1970s, we didn't really have timeout back then. My parents were pretty traditional disciplinarians, which is that we were generally given a warning. And if we did something, we were pretty much told, okay, if you do this specific behavior again, you are going to get a spanking. So if I was stupid enough to do it, I got my behind spanked. And you also have to remember that we didn't have cell phones back then. I didn't even have grow up with video games. They were developing Atari and Pac-Man when I was a girl. So a lot of the things that parents can take away from kids now, such as, you know, your video game or your PlayStation 2 or your cell phone, my parents didn't really have that option. Now, they could say you're not allowed to use the telephone, or you have to go to your bedroom immediately after dinner and you can't watch television. And that did happen. But for the most part, if I misbehaved, I got a spanking. And the final question is, do you prefer books or movies? Great question. I'm much more likely to pick up a book to read than I am to either go to a movie in a movie theater or watch a movie on TV, say, with Netflix or Prime Video. There are shorter shows that I like. I love HGTV. That is one of my favorite channels. So House Hunters, House Hunters International, Tiny Houses, Flip or Flop. I mean, Hometown. I love all of those different home decorating, renovating, buying and selling stores. But it's unusual that I'm going to sit down and actually watch a 2-hour movie. So those are really great questions from some of the youth of the diocese. And hopefully I'll get some more great questions to answer next week. So thank you for tuning in to this week's show of Faithfully Memphis. We will return next Thursday morning at 8 a.m. on WYXR 91.7 FM. So until then, My brothers and sisters, stay safe and stay positive.
The Early Word Morning News Update. For Mary Casciola, I'm Natalie Van Gundy. Today is Thursday, January 14th, and the Tigers were supposed to play their first basketball game of the year.